Our next panel features two very distinguished guests from the beautiful Pacific Northwest. John Classic and Wayne Sparks, joining us from the state of Washington, are longtime leaders in the field of higher education finance. Each of them has extensive experience and plenty of insights to share. Though they've worked in different parts of the financial aid sector in Washington, John and Wayne know each other quite well and have put together some, I believe, some interesting remarks. They will share their presentation with us, and then, of course, we'll turn to you for questions and comments. First of all, I'll give you a quick bio. Wayne Sparks served as financial aid administrator for over 35 years and recently retired from Washington State University in June. Over the past few decades, Wayne has been active in state, regional, and national financial aid organizations. Throughout his career, Wayne served for more than 10 years at each of three public universities: Western Washington University from 1972 through 84, the University of Virginia from 1984 through 95, and Washington State University from 96 to 09. Over the past few decades, Wayne was active in state, regional, and national financial aid organizations, as stated earlier. John Classic is the Director of Student Assistance at the Washington State Higher Education Coordinating Board. In this capacity, he oversees the administration of more than $230 million in state financial aid. With over 35 years of experience, John has held positions at Western Washington University, Illinois Valley Community College, and Illinois State University. In 2002 and 03, John also served as the president of the National Association of State Student Grant and Aid Programs. With that, I turn the mic over to you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. I'm already impressed to see the room is 50% fuller than I thought it would be after lunch. You're all very kind to come back. There were great conversations going on in that room, and I thought, oh gosh, they're going to be sorely tempted. I'm John. This is Wayne, and as Noel said, we have a lot of years of experience between us. The only difference is that Wayne's retired now, and so he can say all that he wants, and there's no way that I can get back whatsoever. Our approach here today is to do a couple of different things. First of all, to give you some sense of what we think has made the program in the state of Washington, particularly the major grant program in the state called the State NEED Grant, successful in terms of two things. One is inspiring significant amounts of appropriation and increasingly significant amounts of appropriation from our legislature, as well as being, I think, fairly well coordinated with institutional aid administrators and how they do business and how they can put things together. I also, though, want to recognize, and Wayne joins me in this, that there is no, we've both had experience in a lot of other states and have sort of studied other states as well. There is no one other state that is a perfect system for everybody. Every state grows its own for a lot of different reasons, and we can get into some of those, but I just want to say we're not here to sell Washington, nor and necessarily any other state. And if you have other states that are saying, hey, we invented sliced bread, be a bit jaundiced about that. That's probably not true. The State NEED Grant Program, the thing that we want to talk about, let me tell you a little bit about it. Some of the features that I think you'll find interesting is that we have essentially an income eligibility criteria that is not necessarily the primary, but it's the most public focus so that a student's final eligibility is based on family income, based on family size. We have a semi-decentralized delivery process, which from an institutional point of view puts a lot of flexibility and a lot of responsibility on their hands to be the ultimate coordinators of the aid. We have tuition-sensitive award amounts so that they are sensitive to increases to public sector tuition and fees, something that our legislature feels very much responsible for because they are responsible for it. We have improved and achieved through, even though we have a somewhat decentralized delivery process, a lot of statewide equity in terms of the opportunity that students, regardless of school, regardless of where in the state they are, have a relatively similar opportunity to access our grants as any other student. And we do this on a pretty low administrative cost that I can talk about here as well. A couple comparisons. When I was looking to see how Washington and Wisconsin relate, I was thinking that, you know, there are quite a number of similarities, and it just highlights the places where we're dissimilar. There's a difference in population, but it's only about a 15% difference, Washington being about 15% greater than Wisconsin. But the total appropriated state aid for all activities, and NEED grant is not just my only program, but there are others. We've got basically twice as much. By the way, I think the date that I quote here, 2007-08, is really should be estimated 08-09. But it's still a significant difference there. And that the rate of change, even over the last 10 years, has been significantly different and higher in Washington. One other point of comparison, research sector tuition and fees. Well, we are both in about the middle of the nation in that regard. We are a little bit, our research sectors, a few hundred dollars behind your research sector tuition and fees. But we're rapidly catching up because we had a 14% tuition and fee increase this year and another 14% slated for next year. And I think yours was 7, something like that. So we're trying to catch up, unfortunately. In terms of our major grant program, that state NEED grant program alone, now this is 2007-08 data, again, we have about twice as much that has now been appropriated and was expended through that grant program. But we're serving about the same number of students. We're currently at about 73,000, and talking with Connie just this morning, I think you are at about 70,000 from last year. But you can see that there's differences in the maximum award, there's differences in the average award. And in that last bottom category, this is the NASGAP kind of comparison. I should mention there is no perfect comparison from one state to another. There's no letter grade. There's no calculation that perfectly compares everything that every state does to everything that every other state does, because we all do it so differently. But one of those measures that I've valued is the need-based dollars divided by for undergraduate students divided by the undergraduate FTE enrollments. And that's been a fairly constant calculation for at least the last 15 years. And that shows that we at Washington are about twice the value of what Wisconsin is at this moment. And this is something that Wayne wanted to talk about. He showed me something yesterday that actually took me back. And so I'll turn it over to him for a moment.
Thank you, John. Since we aren't going to be making our comments separately, I'll just say a few words of thanks to Noel and his staff for inviting me, and also to John for allowing me to come along and be his partner in this presentation. John and I actually got to know each other some time ago when I hired him as our associate director at Western Washington University in 1979. So we've known each other for a long time. And John remembers that one of my management styles is called D&D, or otherwise delegate and disappear. So he was very familiar with that management style. So when I told him as we were preparing this presentation that I'd be happy to just play a cameo role, it didn't surprise him at all. But it is a real pleasure to be here. I've worked with some folks that some of you probably know, Rhonda Norsetter, who's in your chancellor's office. I worked with in the 90s when I was at University of Virginia. Had the pleasure of working with Susan and Jane on our public university aid directors group that meets every year or so. And I even knew those of you who know Wally Dalma, who retired from here 15 years ago. Susan and I had a chance to have lunch with him yesterday, and he and I are both enjoying the same type of employment right now. And after 5 months, I can tell you it's the best job I've ever had. John was a little surprised by this information when I shared it with him. And I think part of the role that I wanted to play in talking with you today is to talk about how the state aid programs in Washington State complement and supplement the other resources that our institutions have available to fund our needy students. And I think this one really brings that home pretty loud and clear. And so what this shows is that in 2005 and 2006, the expenditures for state knee grant recipients at Washington State University exceeded the expenditures for federal Pell Grants. And as you know, the federal Pell Grant program is the largest federal grant program. However, in that year, it exceeded it by about $4 million and has exceeded the Pell Grant expenditures for our students for every year since then. And I don't want to confuse any of you, but for those of you who understand the concept of packaging financial aid, I want to talk about that a little bit. At Washington State University, for years we've had a philosophy that we, for a full need student, we would meet approximately one half of their cost of education or cost of attendance with grant aid. And if they had any parent contribution, that would reduce their eligibility for the grant aid. When our cost of attendance at Washington State University was roughly $20,000 or a little more than that, our grant equity level target was $10,000. Well, what this illustrates, or along with the slide that John put up before, since the state knee grant program is tuition-based, and in those years when our total cost of attendance were roughly $20,000, the cost of tuition was roughly $6,000. So students who had a maximum Pell Grant of $4,000 or so and also had a state knee grant of $6,000, those two resources alone met our students' grant equity requirement. And that's not all the grant aid that the student got, but in terms of packaging financial aid, it's a tremendous boost to the institution to have that state knee grant that is as large an amount as it is. And so I really wanted to point that out. And I would say that the fact that state knee grant exceeded Pell Grants was not only true at the two public research universities, which are University of Washington and Washington State University, it was also true at the other regional universities in the state, six of them, I believe, and it was also true at the private colleges and universities in the state, because the amount of private college tuition or grant is based on the tuition at the doctoral institutions. So for all those sectors, the state knee grant amounts exceeded the Pell Grant amounts, and for me that's really impressive. And I have to say that you get a lot of perspective on a job and a career after you had 4 to 5 months to think about it. And when I was at the institution, I used to think too much about the glass being half full, but as I've left the institution and thought about things like this, I really believe that the glass was half full rather than half empty, and a lot of it has to do with the adequacy of state funding. So you'll find that John and I have sort of a mutual admiration society here. John, I'll give it back to you.
That's absolutely true. I'd also say that I have a huge amount of admiration for Wayne. He's really helped shape a lot of things in our state as well as in Virginia when he was there too. And one other colleague, for those of you who are financial aid administrators in the room, one other colleague that we have in common is Kathy Saloff, who is the Director of Student Aid at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And Wayne and I all work together. In fact, Wayne hired us at Western. So let's turn now to funding and then some of those policies, in particular the decentralized, semi-decentralized system, and then the policies and practices that I think have done more to inspire some of that both coordination as well as the funding growth that we've seen in our state. This is why Nolan identified us and said, hey, we kind of want to talk to these people. Just since 2002, 2003, we've had substantial increases in our need-based state-appropriated student financial aid. A great deal of it has been inspired by the tuition and fee increases that happened at our public institutions, at least 7% per year for every year since then, if not 14% in the last this year and for next year. But we've also had major increases in the service population that the legislature was willing to fund, too. They have extended effectively what we call the income cutoffs upwards, so that instead of serving 54,000 students at the income cutoff where it was in about 2002, 2003, We're now serving over 71. In fact, we'll be over 73,000 for this particular year. This is something that I found of interest as well. It not only shows how that funding has grown since 1985, that's about the time when I joined the board, to where we are now, $212 million for this year, but also that one NASGAP rank that I was talking about. That is the undergraduate dollars divided by undergraduate FTE. We were 18th, and actually this is this era. I understand you can't see that pointer, but at the bottom of that slide, there's kind of a comparison between where Wisconsin has been and where Washington has been. And in 1994, we were both at about the same place, 18th and 17th. And by 2005, we had improved our rank among all the states to 8th. Wisconsin had improved its rank to 14th. But in 2010, we are now, Washington is now number 3. Wisconsin has gone back to being number 17. This is very much illustrates, I think, something that's important for us, and that is that we've been the recipient of significant but routine and regular increases in our funding for a number of years. And in fact, literally since 1992, I can say that the legislature has made significant efforts and has pretty much achieved keeping the lowest income students held harmless from public sector tuition and fee increases on a dollar-for-dollar basis. Guiding principles that I think have helped quite a bit. First of all and foremost, and this comes up a lot, is that financial aid follows the student. And we wind up applying this in a lot of different ways to a lot of different arguments. Opportunity is intended to be equitably spread across the state so that if the opportunity is 8 out of 10 students are going to be eligible, then 8 out of 10 students at every institution, regardless of where they are in the state, regardless of the type of institution, will be eligible, will have an opportunity to access the funding. There is no special allotment for one sector relative to another or for one student relative to another, one kind of student. We have what we think of as a fairly simple and intuitive public eligibility criteria, that is that income. MFI stands for median family income. There's different ways of thinking about something as being simple. From an aid administrator point of view, it may be tying it completely to the EFC outcome. From a kind of a student and family and legislative point of view, simple means give me an income cutoff. Give me something where I can go down here and here and see where I will fall or where my neighbor will fall or where my nephew will fall or something like that. And that's something that we moved to back in about 1992-93. And I think because of where I come from, having worked at a couple of different institutions in the past, not the least of which was at Western with Wayne, the idea that institutions need to be the ultimate coordinators of all financial aid, including the state financial aid. They're in the best place to do it. It's the most efficient way of getting that job done. And lastly, that we make a point of ensuring that we're supporting the state's overall educational goals. I've often made the statement that says that financial aid itself is not the policy. The policy are the state educational goals, of which we continuously think that it ought to always reference and represent access for the lowest income as one of its primary goals, but that's not its only goal. So there are certain flexibilities, there are certain nuances to the program that reflect other state needs and so forth, and we're very responsive to those. The overview of the program here, the semi-decentralized delivery process is something that I wanted to talk about just a little bit. I think you have something similar to that. It sort of looks like the semi-decentralized process we had prior to about 1987 or so. There are still schools have a lot of decision-making authority, but at the same time, there's still quite a bit of interaction that has to happen between the school and the Higher Education Aids Board in order to get a student, before a student can be served with actual monies. We developed this process to say that we want a strong centralized rulemaking authority. In other words, we'll set up the criteria about what the eligible student looks like, and then we'll tell you, the school, using the regular application process, the FAFSA, and anything else that you send a student through, to identify which of those students meet those criteria, and then to decide if there's limited funding, which of those students will receive those funds. We ask you to blend it as an institution. We ask you to blend it with your other institutional and federal and private sources of assistance to come up with an adequate package for all students, but that is essentially in the hands of the schools. One of the things that makes this possible is our ability to set aside a reserve for the body of students at each one of the schools. Essentially, it looks like an allocation or an allotment, but it follows, again, it's intended to follow the student, not necessarily the school, and allow the schools then to know well in advance about how much money they have available to them, know that the money that their students has been reserved for their students is equivalent to the needs of students in every other school, and then to go forward and claim those monies as they need them, as they identify students. There's no delay whatsoever, and we get those monies transferred quite quickly as they need them. This, I think, is very much made possible by that fair share allotment formula that is based on, well, it's an intent to distribute those monies, again, in such a way that opportunity is equitably distributed. And that from an institutional point of view, that maybe the downside or maybe the good side of it is that we do it with a lot of information that the schools provide us. They don't have to check with us before they serve an eligible student. They just serve them, they claim the money, they're on their way. But they do have to report to us a lot about at least on a quarterly basis, who that student was, what made them eligible, what they looked like, what their enrollment was, and so forth and so on. And it's that information that we use to make sure that that opportunity is equitably distributed.
Okay, John gave me an opportunity to say a few words here, and I want to talk particularly about the notification to the schools of their reserve for the next year. The first two institutions that I worked at, Western Washington University and University of Virginia, were not what I would call enrollment-challenged institutions. However, I can say this because I'm retired and more than 1,000 miles away from Pullman. Washington State University was, for a number of years that I was there, what you might call an enrollment-challenged institution. And that imposes some additional expectations on the financial aid office in terms of its role in enrollment management. One of those expectations is that you notify prospective students as early as possible what kind of financial aid they will be receiving at your institution. And so John always knew that every year in late February or early March, he would start getting calls and emails from my staff and I asking him, what is our reserve for next year? What will the state NEED grant award amount be for next year? And what are the MFI levels? And thank goodness, John and I never had to debate over that issue very much, because usually by early March, they came through for us with that information. Sometimes they had to wait for the release of the information from the BLS, I think, for MFI numbers. But still, their timelines were very much cognizant of the needs that the institutions had for receiving those reserve amounts. And the good thing also is that because the trend of state NEED grant appropriations in the state has been upward, when we received those reserve amounts, we never had to worry that we would get less than that amount during the course of the academic year. The only thing we could get that would change that amount would be a supplemental allocation. And that depended a lot on the ability of all of the schools in the state to accurately and in a timely fashion report their expenditure patterns. And here's where the state coordinating body relies very heavily on the accountability of the institutions, because it causes them problems if some institution knows that they're running way behind in their expenditures and they don't let John's staff know until late in the year, when it's too late to reallocate the money to other institutions. So that feature of the state NEED grant was a tremendous feature, because when John and I talked about ideal elements of a state NEED grant program, For me, they included timely information to make awards to students and then timely allocation or disbursement of the funds to the institution so that we weren't dispersing money to students in the fall and then waiting a substantial length of time to get reimbursed, so to speak, from John's staff. So those two things worked very well for us.
So we started this fair share allocation process basically in about 1990 or so, and it was entirely intended to distribute funds more equitably than the way in which we had been doing it prior to about 1990. Kind of the organic process about how state programs evolve, while we're pulling in this information to be able to distribute dollars equitably, it also sort of dawned on us, hey, we can tell you exactly now how much it really should cost in a perfect world, depending on the service population and the award amounts and some of those nuances around there. That this allocation model then also became a costing model that we could then share with the legislature. Another exceptionally important thing that I think has helped inspiration for additional funding that I want to get to here at the end. The state funding goals happen to be one of those other things that I think have really helped to inspire some of that legislative support. There are two primary goals. There are somewhat minor goals, but the two primary ones is to keep pace with public sector tuition and fees. In about 1998, we changed our grant award process, and this was something that at first I was not in favor of, but I've come to be a big believer in it. To have the grant awards based on public sector tuition and fees. It turned out to be an aha moment on my part when I realized that every year for like the previous eight years, the legislative staff would be coming up to me and saying, now we're raising tuition by whatever percent it was, how much of that, of the increase that we give you will help offset what the students are paying in tuition? And I always had to go through a whole bunch of calculations to figure out just how much it was needed and how it would happen and so forth. And then even though it was in front of me all this time, I realized the legislature in our state is responsible for undergraduate tuition and fee rates. They set a maximum. Schools go up to that maximum, but it's effectively set by our legislature. Our legislature also sets per FTE appropriations. And so if there's an increase in number of FTEs, they will appropriate dollars for them. Those were the two things that they felt not only in charge of, but responsible for. And therefore, we changed that modeling around so that it reflected exactly those responsibilities and gave them, the legislature, an opportunity to see what the impact of their actions on tuition and fee increases, on FTE increases, may be. I think that, in more than anything in the world since 1998, has really helped us a lot. The other is development of kind of a mantra. Now, there aren't that many mantras in the world that I care for, but I was trying to think of a simple way to describe what we want the legislature to do, and this was like back in 98 or so, and that was to hold the lowest income students harmless from tuition and fee increases on a dollar-for-dollar basis. And I was just using those words as a way to describe to legislative staff what we're trying to do. But I was surprised in 2005 that there was a study that was done out of Illinois of states during recessionary periods, and they came out to Washington, they went to a number of other states, and interviewed key personnel, including politicians and so forth, about state-to-state aid programs. They interviewed two of our our current governor at that time and our previous governor, and both of them, when asked, well, what's the primary goal for funding state student financial aid? And they repeated this: hold the lowest income students harmless from tuition and fee increases on a dollar for dollar basis. I'm going, wow, I didn't know that, and I'm kind of happy about that. You know, I did something good here. So that incorporation or inculcation of something simple into just the everyday kind of sense of what a institution's or a legislature's responsibilities are, again, I think has helped us a great deal. The other is that simplified income eligibility criteria. It's really a secondary rationing formula. The first eligibility criteria is that the student have demonstrated financial need using federal methodology. But that just draws the big circle of who's in the arena to be looked at. Within that, though, a secondary rationing factor in most states, and I'm sure that Wisconsin has this as well, has a way of identifying who within the great body of needy students is actually going to receive service. And in our case, that is this income cutoff. It's based on median family income, which is something that is generated by the U.S. Census Bureau on an annual basis. It's what they call the four-person family income, median family income by state, and it can be divided up by family size, so it's sensitive to a different income standard for a family of two or a family of six or a family of four. Again, one of the benefits is that I don't get to make up what that income standard is. It's the U.S. Census Bureau, so it comes from outside of the state. The legislature doesn't get to set that income standard. It comes from outside of the state. Wayne, actually, we're jumping into that. I wanted to make sure there's at least one slide in there where Wayne gets to just level with us.
Okay. This is my turn again. The role of the coordinating board, that is an extremely important role, articulating the needs of the institutions and the students within the state in a way that is understandable to the legislature. And I think that John and his predecessors have done a rather masterful job of doing that. I have been in at least one other state, and I can see how things go awry if the state coordinating body, like John's organization, is not successful in articulating needs to the legislature in a way that they can understand and fully commit to. My example is from the state of Virginia, where in the early years that I was there, we had the kind of state aid program that every financial aid administrator dreams about, which is called discretionary aid. And each institution and each aid director and their staffs decided how the money would be spent, and it was allocated to us from the state agency. Well, you might imagine the downside of that over time, and that is that state legislators and congressmen have a tendency to go by the golden rule, and all of you know that. He who has the gold makes the rules. And when the state legislators realized that there's a lot of money out there in the institutions that they have directed to the institutions, and each and every institution has made a different decision about how that money would be spent, their reaction is not always in a positive direction. The result of the legislators in Virginia was to convert what had previously been a discretionary student aid program to a non-discretionary, highly prescriptive aid program that was almost so cumbersome that it was impossible to administer. So I have seen what can happen if the trust level does not exist between the legislators that appropriate the money and the financial aid administrators that distribute the money. So I think that between the two states, there's a very good balance in Washington State between the flexibility that all of us seek as aid administrators and the accountability that our legislators are looking for. And, of course, in this situation, institutions play a very important role. The state has done a very good job of articulating to each and every one of our institutions who the needy population is or the eligible population is for the state need grant program. It is then the institution's responsibility to select those students and to report that information to the Higher Education Coordinating Board so that they can assure the legislators next time it's time to appropriate money that the funds have been used appropriately. And I can say very happily that in my 13 years at Washington State University and at the other universities as well, we never had an exception in terms of audits. So there was no reason to question, and I think John and his staff weren't just making us feel good by saying that they could always count on our reports being there on time and accurate. And that's where the schools play a very important role in terms of, and one of the things I used to hear a lot about in my early days in student aid, you don't hear so much about these days, is a federal-state institutional partnership in delivering financial aid to students. And you don't hear a lot about that now, but it obviously has to exist. And all the partners have to trust each other, or the system doesn't work. So I think John and his staff have done a great job of that. One of the examples of how the schools have worked with John and his staff is from time to time, aid administrators would say, you know, it would be a lot easier if our state NE grant program was based on estimated family contribution, EFC, which is the mantra of the federal system and the FAFSA and so forth. And why don't we just convert our state eligibility to an EFC? It would be so much easier for us. And the response that we have consistently gotten from John and his staff is, you don't realize how much more difficult it would be to communicate our state aid program to our legislators if we tried to communicate to them in terms of EFCs. All of us in financial aid have had that experience we call eyes glazed over. And as complicated as a federal need analysis system, it's pretty easy to get an eyes glazed over response relatively early in the conversation. Whereas when you use the term median family income in talking with legislators, it seems to be a much better way to carry out a conversation with them. And this is, again, where the financial aid community has to cooperate and support the agency, because we then need to understand that there would be a loss in the HEC board's ability to communicate the need for financial aid programs if they had to talk in terms of EFC rather than MFI. So that's another way that we coordinate and complement each other's efforts. Another thing that we appreciate is the professional judgment. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with professional judgment or the financial aid administrators ability to look at a family situation and see that the great computer in the sky that processes FAFSAs generated a result that isn't realistic for that particular family because of some unique family circumstances, such as a change in family income, the loss of a parent or major wage earner in the family. And this is where I really think that institutional aid administrators play probably the most important role that they can possibly play, and that is adding the element of judgment and professional discretion to those unique family situations that so many of our families have. And as John pointed out to me in the last couple of days as we talked about that, never in his time at the HEC board, which is many years, have they questioned the judgment of a professional aid administrator that resulted in eligibility for state NE grant for a student. And that's the kind of support that all of us would wish for from a state agency, that they wouldn't be second-guessing us or asking us to prove or document the reason for our decision and that kind of thing. So that's another reason why the program works so well. One other thing I wanted to talk about that isn't necessarily part of the resources that the Higher Education Coordinating Board provides to the institutions, but it's something that the state legislature did many years ago that makes the job of the institutional aid administrators somewhat easier because of availability of resources. There are a couple of programs. I believe, was it in the 80s, John, that the 3.5% state student aid program was created?
Right.
In the 80s, the legislature in Washington created a what we call a 3.5% state student aid program. And basically what they did with this program was to say that out of every dollar collected for tuition and fees at each public institution in the state, 3.5% of those dollars must be set aside for need-based financial aid. Now, other than the fact that the aid has to go to needy students, there's not a lot of prescriptiveness about that program. So the institutions have some flexibility in the use of that program. And one of the things that we did at Washington State University quite successfully is that we, what you might call, co-managed our 3.5% student aid program with the state need grant program and the reserves that we had available. An example of that would be, say, the state advised us that we had $15 million to spend in state need grant, and we went about the awarding process, and we realized that we had students eligible that would require an expenditure of $17 million in state need grant that year. What we would do is make sure that we protected that additional commitment, which we made based on the fact that those students were state need grant eligible, and even though we didn't have the funds, we would protect that commitment with our 3.5% state aid fund so that we didn't overexpend if, for some reason, the state didn't get us the additional money we needed for the eligible students. Happily and luckily, in many cases, if we reported to the student that we had $2 million, or to John's agency that we had $2 million in unserved students with state need grant, they would be communicating with other institutions who might have more funds than they needed, and at some point in the year, we would get a supplemental allocation. It might not be the full $2 million we needed, it might be $1 million or $1.5 million, but that was that much less of our 3.5% state aid money that we had to use to fulfill the commitment to students who are state need grant eligible. So I hope I'm not confusing you too much by this discussion, but it was a way that we found to very, very successfully manage the two programs and make sure that even though we didn't have a commitment up front from John's organization to fund all of the state need grant eligible students, we could give them the grant, and often we would get the funds through a de-obligation, re-obligation process to fund that. So that was a very good part of the program. John asked me to talk about what are the drawbacks of the program. That's kind of a tough one, and you know, as long as John keeps sending me that monthly stipend that I get, it's going to be hard for me to come up with an answer to that. But I did think of one thing, and that is, I've alluded to this earlier, it depends, the system and process depends a lot on institutional responsibility. Again, it's a shared responsibility. And when John's organization tells you that an interim report for the state need grant program is due November 15th, you need to make sure that you tell them on November 15th how many students you're serving and how many of your students are unserved. That is, how many students are eligible for state need grant who have not received it. In our case, we usually gave it to them and funded it with 3.5% state aid money. But another thing about the semantics here is it's a lot easier for John's organization to go to the legislature and say, we had $3 million or $5 million in state need grant eligibility that we were unable to serve. One of the problems from my time in Virginia is we all tried to tell the state legislature how much unmet need we had at all of our institutions. And normally their response when we went to them and gave them some gigantic number for the amount of unmet need of our students in the state was, how could it be unmet need? Those students are all enrolled. So if they needed the money and they're enrolled, did they really need the money? So it went to that kind of a conversation when you talked about unmet need, but when you go to the legislature and say the students are here, they're enrolled, and they're not being served by our state need grant program, which you wanted them to be served by, it's a lot better argument. So that's what I would have to say about state need grant from the school perspective. And, John, I'm sorry if I didn't give you enough trouble on this one.
Thank you, Wayne. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. The, one other thing about institutional assistance here, and I'm not sure the extent to which this is reflected in Wisconsin or not, but not only is it that 3.5% that is required, but institutions also have at least a portion of their tuition and fee waivers, this is the public institutions, that are funded or supported in part by state appropriations. Effectively, because we have a unit record report that we get at the end of the year, which is a student-by-student accounting of all the dollars they've received and some demographic data as well, I can report that our public institutions are probably expending at least 6% of their tuition and fee collections for undergraduate students on needy students, and in some cases it's as high as 10%, 11%, something like that. That has helped tremendously, and again, the institution is the ultimate coordinator of that financial aid package. It blends very nicely. And while I think there's a lot to be said from that statewide centralized point of view, centralizing that opportunity, I'm a big supporter of institutional assistance as well and do everything I can to try to maintain it and increase it. Just a couple of things to wrap up here, and those of you who take a look at the presentation on the website, you'll see that there's other slides that we have in here, but there are just kind of if we had the time, if the question comes up, or the subject is a little bit detailed, and some of you may want to have some more details later on you can look at. But I just wanted to sort of end with this. And that's some of the keys to both the success of the program in terms of coordination and in terms of the funding is that semi-decentralized process that mirrors the best of what a centralized process would have been able to do in terms of statewide equity between students and schools. Secondly, that costing model that can be used by the legislative staff, it's essentially a big Excel workbook that has just evolved and keeps evolving year after year as the legislature asks us to have the ability to model more and more complex sorts of scenarios. And by the way, I give them this workbook. I give the legislative staff in our Appropriations and Ways and Means Committee this workbook, and they can plug in their own tuition and fee rates and their own budgeted FTEs and some of their own modifications if they choose to do that for award amounts and see exactly what the consequences are. And for the most part, I think personally that it brings them into the process and brings their members into the process as well and helps them share in knowing what those needs are. By the way, it's built on indisputable information coming from the institutions. It is the absolute student-by-student reconciliation of who's eligible, who got served, who was left unserved, but it's indisputable. This is what the real needs are based on our program criteria. And again, just the sense of transparency that it provides. One thing that I should also say is that we are a pretty inclusive state. Not only are the public two-year and four-year institutions participating, as are the private independent four-year colleges and universities, but we also include a fair number of the proprietary schools, 15 proprietary schools, for-profit institutions in our state as well. It's a big tent. Everybody's inside the tent, and hopefully everybody continues to be pulling for the same goal. No sector specificity for those allocations. And we have a low-cost state administration. I believe Wisconsin has a low cost as well. Ours, on that $212 million, is basically run on a day-to-day basis by maybe one person, maybe two people, depending upon how you count them and what the tasks are. And over the course of a year, taking into account the policy issues that have to come up and IT and accounting and other things, some data reconciliation needs, maybe the equivalent of about five FTEs on a year-round basis. But effectively, we don't need more staff in order to be able to administer more money. We just need the staff that we have and good systems, and that's what we do. So that's the place where I'm going to end. Like I say, there's other slides on here that you're welcome to look at or may come up if you have questions. But at this point, no questions? Can you tell us how long we have?
Yeah. We'll take questions. We've modified the timetable a little bit, so we're going to go until 2:20. So we'll take questions. Sharon.
on that one slide that had the dollar amounts, the line graph, did that include the 3.5% institutional? That's just the state grant program. Okay.
That's
and
right.
And then at the state level, do you have any merit-based programs? Wisconsin has an academic excellence scholars program that is merit-based. And I was just wondering if it was a...
We do have a merit-based program. In fact, we actually have two of them. They're relatively small, a total of about $3.5 million. One is for the top one-third of 1% of each graduating high school class. It's a four-year tuition and fee, a waiver, essentially, at the public four-year institutions funded by the state, funded through us, and one for vocationally oriented students as well. It's relatively small. We had a much larger program for about 5 years called the Promise Scholarship Program that went to the top 15% of each graduating high school class. It was a prorated award, and awards ranged from $1,000 to $2,000 depending upon the year. But when we had a money crunch just a couple of years ago, about 2005, the legislature chopped it, put it into the need-based aid programs. So, yes, we do have merit-based programs, but it's a relatively small amount relative to everything else.
One thing that John may not have mentioned with regard to that merit-based aid program that was with us for a few years and then went away, even when we had it, it had an income threshold to it, which I could appreciate as
yes.
one
mm-hmm.
who doesn't want to see a lot of merit-based aid going to students without regard to family income.
Yeah, it's a little bit high threshold, 125% of the state's median family income, but a threshold all the same. And that was very much appreciated.
Question there, and then also in the back.
Just like to again thank you for coming and sharing with us in terms of the work that you're doing. We appreciate it. I have a two-pronged question. How is the initial allocation made to each school? What specifically is the formula in terms of allocating funds to the schools, and you know what it's based on? And then realizing that the funds are being allocated to individual schools, how is it that you consider the program one in which the funding is following the student?
Really excellent questions, and very you know, sort of get to the heart of the technical part of what we wind up doing. The schools report to us for every single student that's enrolled there, their eligibility, whether they were received money or not for our program, and they give us enough information that we can then student by student figure out what they would have received had we had enough money. So essentially, I'm taking a model. I'm developing a model that takes into account every single student, 75,000 to 78,000 students in the state, calculating their eligibility, looking at their enrollment, and figuring out if we had had all the money in the world, how much would it have cost, and what is the percentage of that total cost that I would have ascribed to, say, the University of Washington, the other UW that loses all of its football games. But how much I just had to get that in because you guys won. how much of that total pot would have gone, say, to the University of Washington or to the smallest school, Claire's Beauty College in Pasco, Washington, a school with about 57 students in it. Then whatever appropriation I do have, I will assign the same percentage of dollars to each one of those schools. Therefore, the students at the University of Washington will have the same opportunity to access the dollars as at the Claire's Beauty School in Pasco. So in a rough version, that's what we get to. And like I say, it turns itself into an Excel workbook of which there is that exact calculation of percentage share of the body of need for the body of students at each one of the institutions that I can then calculate and appropriate, or I should say allocate out the dollars. The language is also important for us. When we moved to this system, we had to overcome a number of legal hurdles, not the least of which was within our own Attorney General's office. And our Attorney General basically said, you need to show us that, in fact, you will achieve not only the same but better equity than what we have now through your model. And we were able to do that. And we continue to be able to do that by looking retrospectively. How did we do in the last year? Was the percentage of unserved students by school different over here than it was over there? How much different was it? Did we have the right information to begin with? And we've got it down. These are all doable things, and in fact, I think we've managed to achieve that. Okay. I'm using.
You're using cost in the formula. Are you using a standard cost of attendance, or are you using established cost of attendance on each campus?
Are we developing a cost of attendance for each student? Think about what it is that we're trying to model. We're trying to model eligibility for the state program that is based on tuition and fees. So we know if somebody is at a certain income level and going to a certain school that their eligibility is for an award that's pretty close to equaling tuition and fees at that institution. It doesn't necessarily take into account, nor does it have to take into account, cost of attendance, you know, the room and board and the other elements. It's really cost relative to our program goals.
So you're just including tuition and fees in that?
Tuition and fees.
Some questions, Bo, in the back, and then we'll come back.
John, I have two questions. If you have a student transfer from one school to another in semester, what happens to their grant?
Good point.
Then secondly, I'm not sure how your state budget process works, but if the legislature has not figured out how much money is going to financial aid, how do you figure out what the allocation is for the upcoming year?
The first question first, regarding transfer students, that is one of the key components that we put into the program to make sure that the aid follows the student so that the student can transfer from school to school and not lose eligibility. Essentially, I reserve a little bit of money, and it's always been more than enough, to accommodate a transferring student's needs. So if a student transfers from that Claire's Beauty College to the University of Washington or the other way around, I will ensure that there's money available for that student at the receiving institution. And the home institution doesn't have to give up money in order to accommodate that. In terms of the budgeting process, for every year, with the exception perhaps of what's coming up here, you have a certain base, and you can pretty much count. Well, I've always been able to count on that base for 30 years, and therefore, at least to the extent of the base, I know what I can give out to institutions, and I can give each one of the institutions essentially a conditional guarantee. Our conditional guarantee has been 90% of what you expended in the previous year, and we've rarely found that was too much or too little. And then after the legislative session finishes, after the schools report what their total reconciled population looked like from the previous year, then we will distribute the remaining 10%, and that usually happens sometime after July 1st and before about mid-August.
Thank you, Paul Nelson, Wisconsin Association of Independent Colleges and Universities. One of the things that I think we've been concerned about is the financial aid in Wisconsin now with three major grant programs, or four if you count the tribal WEG, is it's a zero-sum game. Excuse me. And I think students attending each of our sectors of campuses have been hurt in one biennium or another when, you know, a dollar of aid for this student is a dollar less of aid for that student. And certainly this model certainly seems to have an edge over that in terms of everybody kind of getting behind increased financial aid for students. A question is, what were things like before the state need grant? That's the question. The comment is, I think we'd certainly want to see, or I would be interested in seeing some outcome measures. You had a good table at the beginning that showed that Washington was ahead of Wisconsin in terms of financial aid inputs, but I think it would be really interesting to have additional columns in that table, and maybe the WISCAPE research folks could do that as a follow-on to this meeting. State taxpayer costs per degree, educational attainment, some kind of equity measures I think would be really important to have.
Second question first in this case. Those are exactly the questions that we ask ourselves. And with the hopefully soon to be passed College Access and Completion Fund, that will do has a lot more opportunities to ensure that states develop this kind of information. We've been doing that as well. Within the last 2 years have we been able to connect the educational outcomes of any student, whether a financial aid recipient or not, with what's actually happened and being reported back by the institutions. We have something called the ERDC, Education Research Data Center, that's really run out of an arm of our governor's office, really because no sector wanted to let any other sector have that data by itself. But that's starting to do some really good work to come up with those outcomes measurable strictly for Washington. And it would be interesting to see how that stacks up and what's making a difference and what's not making a difference and where the weaknesses are in our educational system that allows somebody to access but not to succeed or retain or persist. The first part of your question, what was it like before we moved to the fair share model, essentially? Well, we had a semi-decentralized system, but it was almost exclusively based on, or inadvertently almost based on, when a student applied. And therefore, the earlier a student applied, the more likely it was that they would be served. That resulted in, and it became eminently clear to me when I took over the job that I took over in the mid-80s, that the students who apply earliest are the students at the four-year institutions, public and private. The students who apply the latest, students in community and technical colleges. Big discrepancy when I started looking at a statewide need for assistance and who was getting it based on the date of application. And therefore, we went through the kind of process. It really gave some impetus to going through the kind of process we have now for that fair share that takes a look at the needs of students on a year, a total 12-month basis, and figures out what that percentage would otherwise be and distributes the available dollars on the basis of that percentage.
Paul, I'd like to add a little bit also from my perspective. John and I talked about of the variety of things we could discuss during this session, whether we should address retention and graduation, and we sort of decided between us that we had enough on our plates, and it's not that we didn't want to talk about outcomes and retention and graduation, but we just didn't feel like we had enough time to talk about it. But since you ask, I will just mention that certainly retention and graduation was very much on my mind and many others at Washington State University. We were privileged, I would say, to participate as one of 15 institutions that were studied about 3 or 4 years ago by the Pell Institute for Higher Education Opportunity. And they were looking at how to improve the graduation rates of students from low-income families. And they did two studies on this. The first study included a combination of independent colleges and universities and public. The second one they did included only relatively large public universities across the country. And Washington State University was chosen because we had a relatively large population of Pell Grant recipients. And so they came in and looked at our institution pretty thoroughly, and their report, which is called Geography is Not Destiny, is on the Pell Institute website. And I think particularly for those from public universities, it might be a good resource. But I'll brag a little bit here that WSU of the 15 institutions was determined to be in the top tier, and I believe there are 4 or 5 of the 15 institutions in the top tier. And we were labeled with high, which meant our graduation rates were higher than the national average for college graduation. And secondly, our graduation rates were higher than they would be predicted to be for the academic profile of our students when they arrived at WSU. And so that's something that we spent a lot of time looking at and thinking about. And I know this morning we were talking about are we really looking for access and opportunity, or are we looking for success? And I think what we concluded is it's not either or, it's both. And so when I talk about access and opportunity, I can't leave that unfinished without talking about success. Because if we're providing access to our revolving door, and students are leaving after a year or two and leaving with indebtedness and they're defaulting, that word gets out, and that will really frustrate our efforts to recruit students to higher education. So that's kind of my soapbox.
Okay. Another question in the back?
Do you have limits as far as number of semesters available for use by a student, residency, or child support?
We do on all of those. It's 10 semesters, 15 quarters is the maximum. 125% of the published length of program is another maximum. Child support, there is actually a component of the program that does allow for a dependent care allowance. I'm not sure if that's what you meant or not. I've forgotten, what was the other component you asked about? Yes. Yes, must be a resident of the state of Washington. And in fact, residency is really interesting in that it occurred to me that the only reason a residency law even exists in the state of Washington is for the purposes of resident tuition and fees and financial aid. Maybe other states that way too.
Additional questions? There's one up front here, Bo.
Effectively with legislators, and that income is a better way of communicating than EFC. When did you start? Do you collect income on your student application? Are you relying on the FAFSA? And if it, I'm assuming it's on the student application. And when was that a tough conversation, or was it? How did you get it on the application if you did?
The application, by the way, the key to the question about income is really the where is it coming from? And it comes from the FAFSA. So there's no separate state application in Washington. I think you have a similar sort of process where you rely on the information. The student only needs to fill out one form. That's the FAFSA. As all the rhetoric around is too complicated, I mean, the state aid process is too complicated. Nobody knows how, you know, this is the kind of thing you get from legislators all the time. Nobody knows. But all the simplest statement is fill out the FAFSA. And you're not only applying for federal and institutional aid, you're applying for all the state aid programs as well, period. So the information comes from there, and of course it's vetted through the schools through the verification process. It's so straightforward. It's the same income information that the school will use to allocate or to award its own institutional assistance. Was it a hard process? Of course, everything had its big challenges that we were able to overcome. But I'll tell you, interestingly enough, the history behind it that finally nudged us to this place. I'd been looking for simplified kinds of eligibility criteria, playing around with that for five, six, 7 years before we actually got there, looking at Pell indexes and Pell eligibility and EFCs and so forth. Never really quite came up with anything and didn't have a whole lot of momentum behind it anyway. But in about 1992, 93, and I've forgotten exactly what it was, the federal government made a change to congressional methodology at that time that would have overnight added about $3 to $5 million of extra cost onto our program the way we had it previously configured. And we just couldn't imagine ourselves walking into our legislative offices at that time saying, and sorry to tell you, but it's going to cost you $5 million more. And no, the financial strength of no student changed. It's just that the federal government decided to change its process. So we know we can't disconnect, nor do we want to disconnect ourselves necessarily from federal methodology or the needs analysis. But we did want to provide ourselves with a little bit of distance and not feel like we were a leaf being blown around in the tornado of federal politically motivated changes. And that then helped lead us to this income cutoff. And it just happened to be that when we started looking at standards like poverty levels or median family income levels, and there's some connections between the two. We were, and with some you know, calculations on our part, we were able to figure out that we could identify 97% of the same students who were being identified basically using a kind of congressional methodology-like look to our system. And we found it. We were kind of lucky. We were kind of smart. And we got it done. And once we got to the point where we could say, look, we can identify 97% of the same students, and the 3% of the students who trade off, well, you can kind of, you know, not only live with it, but there's some, it makes some sense about why they trade off. Congressional methodology wasn't perfect. Income's not perfect, but it's not bad. So at any rate, then our own board was able to adopt that, and the legislature, in fact, bought into it in a big way.
Additional questions? Rapidly approaching the 2:20 period. Yes. Okay. Seeing none, I want to thank John and Wayne for traveling all the way from the state of Washington for the presentation. Thank you.